This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
I feel a lot of pressure to show up and kind of give them an answer. And then he said something like, you know, I'm getting really interested in not knowing. And I said, what the hell is this guy talking about? And that makes me wonder, do you all feel pressure to know the answer? And they were all just like, yes, and just kind of like unleashed this kind of tension in the room to recognize that the conversation around complexity is the conversation that you are in. The safety community in particular should be kind of applauded for this. Safety leadership really puts the fact that we're working in a complex system first and we need to focus on learning and these things. And I think that's one of the reasons why Meltdown has landed in the safety community.
You could be quite a big business, to be fair, and still have a lot of it essentially go through one person. I can see it in a lot of our customers as well. When I'm looking at leaders in a business and it's just like everyone looks to you for an answer, you must be shattered.
You've got to match people's energy and the level of engagement you're willing to take from them. You know what strategy you want, but you want people to feel like they have gone through some kind of participatory process. Like, don't do that. You've burned a tremendous amount of trust and political capital with people. Okay, that's a great idea. How am I going to do that? How am I going to actually create that culture where people are curious and open and discussing mistakes and seeing these as learning moments rather than being in that kind of blame framework?
All right, Chris, welcome back to the podcast, mate.
James, good to see you again. Thank you for having me.
Hey, no worries, mate. No worries. When you emailed me asking for like a testimonial of you going on another podcast, I mean what I said in that you were genuinely the nicest person I think I've ever spoke to on this podcast. It was such a pleasure to talk to you the first time around. So I'm looking forward to it this time.
Yeah, that's so sweet. I'm looking forward to it too. And we were just looking. It was 2 years ago, almost exactly 2 years ago, right?
Yeah, 2 years ago. Yeah, so unless now the power and success that you've had has gone to your head and you're now just a really arrogant, horrible man, hopefully, which I'm sure that's not the case.
Well, I'll let you be the judge. We can do a judgment lightning round at the end. Is that what this work is all about, judgment, right?
Yeah. So when we last spoke, if I was to say like it was early doors for you, that would be kind of offensive. It wasn't, but like you wrote Meltdown and then it really has just, from my perspective anyway, you seem to have blown up since then. And just the work and stuff you're doing, like you're kind of everywhere, which is amazing. But the last we spoke, we really did just get into Meltdown. I'll be really interested to see what else you're working on now. But how has that kind of period of growth been? Because that's madness.
Yeah, it's been fascinating and fantastic and a lot of self and personal growth and a lot of leading growth in my team to kind of get here. The phrase that I use is, I feel like I'm an overnight success after only 10 years of trying, because that's really, that's really what it feels like. You know, I started on this journey really in 2013, left my Wall Street job. I guess I should say, so I'm Chris Clearfield. I'm the founder and CEO of the Clearfield Group. And what we do is a couple of different things, but mostly we work with senior leaders in organizations that have a real background in expertise, usually some kind of expertise, safety, engineering, law, software. And now they're in leadership roles where they really benefit from letting that expertise sort of fade into the background and kind of inform their work rather than them leading with that expertise. So I help leaders build cohesive and empowered teams that can really drive results within their organizations. Sometimes that's focused on the team itself. Sometimes it's focused on their strategy, but it's also often focused on building trust and influence throughout the organization. A lot of the leaders I work with are leaders who are catalyzing change across a larger organization or even in their own line organization. And change is hard. So I spend a lot of my work kind of working on change and supporting leaders who are really creating transformational change in their organizations. So in 2013, when I started out, I had, you know, no idea that that's what I was going to be doing. I didn't have the skills to do that. I didn't really have a framework, you know, really, It's interesting because thinking about it now, you know, my co-author and I, we started writing Meltdown in the end of 2015, early 2016. It came out in 2018. And in some sense, I sort of, you know, expected the book to come out and then, you know, to start getting calls, people for people to help. And that happened to some extent. I mean, people really were reading the book and reaching out and connecting. You know, Meltdown is a book that is that I'm very, very proud of. And it requires a certain level of kind of, I don't want to say sophistication, but to recognize that the conversation around complexity is the conversation that you are in as a leader at work. Like that really requires some reflection and some ability to step back from your day to day. And while a lot of leaders, you know, do have that, and I think the safety community in particular should be kind of applauded for this because, you know, safety leadership, at least in this kind of, you know, new conception, really puts the fact that we're working in a complex system first, and we need to focus on learning and these things. And I think that's one of the reasons why Meltdown has landed in the safety community, because it's been sort of ready for the conversation. You know, and to your point, the difference between where I am now versus where I am in 2021, I mean, just really does feel like night and day in terms of the what I'm able to bring to the work that I'm able to do, the kind of you know, the leaders that I get to work with are sort of still similar in character, but there's just more of them now, and I'm getting to have a broader impact, which is pretty cool.
Was cool. That was really cool. I was reflecting on what you said there about your book, because I always kind of, if someone said to me I'd describe Meltdown, I would kind of say it's like a really good gateway book to the world of complexity and normal accident theory and that, because the way that you and Alexandra, is that right?
Andras.
Andras, sorry, that was it. The way that you and Andras kind of wrote the book was, it's easy to read. And these are really complex, ironically, they're really complex theories, and like they had, look, to your point, it needs a level of maturity. But I kind of, maybe I've been describing it wrong. Maybe you do need a bit of a, I just found it really actually a pleasure to read, and actually it kind of, I remember reading your book going, oh, actually, no, I do have this understanding, right? Whereas when I've read all of the academia, I was like, I think I've got this. Whereas then I'd read how you guys kind of wrote the book and then tied it to tangible stories, FYI, which I've stolen all of them, just used them in all of my workshops. But how you kind of turned up, oh, yeah, that's how I would talk about it, actually. And then, so I found it actually like, I don't know, maybe it's not a gateway book, but ultimately that's how I saw it.
No, I think I mean, this is a great distinction to kind of play in for a moment, because I think you're right. I really think it is a gateway book. And, you know, and I'm really proud of, I mean, the book really does build a bridge between kind of, you know, you come in and you're maybe interested about this topic, or you're interested in safety or risk or complexity. And this is, I think, this book really does build a bridge. I mean, again, I'm really proud of it. I think we do a good job bringing these anecdotes in, bringing all these stories in, to kind of bring these points to life. Because, you know, I mean, some of us are risk nerds and kind of love, you know, love anything that involves any kind of failure. But the stories is what brings it to life, and I like the way we tell the stories. I think if I were to tell, you know, my 2015 self, if I were to give my 2015 self some advice around writing a book, I think the advice I would give is, I would say, look, you can write a great book about anything. And so what is it time for, with this book? In other words, I think there was a, and this is just a commercial question at some point. It's almost more like a marketing question than a kind of content question. And the marketing question is like, you know, what's the conversation that people are already in that you can contribute to, right? So there's a danger in that, because if you show up just as another kind of commodity in the ongoing conversation, it's not helpful or interesting. And I think what we really are doing is contributing to a new conversation that is just starting. And from the perspective of like a tool of, you know, from the perspective of marketing a book, you'd kind of rather be in a conversation that exists in some sense. Like you'd like to make a splash in a conversation that exists rather than have to create a whole new conversation. You know, I think about like Malcolm Gladwell, right? So, you know, he really has created this whole genre in some sense of this kind of, you know, very accessible narrative nonfiction. I mean, they're like this kind of research driven nonfiction. I mean, he really created that, that genre. And now he's such a go-to in that space. Why am I thinking of that? I don't know. I don't know if that's interesting, but they're,
It's a similar, actually, like when you kind of made that connection there, like thinking about it now, I could see the inspiration in that, actually, like that there is a style of writing now that's non-fiction storytelling in a way, like
right.
You've got yourselves, you've got Gladwell, you know, Matthew Syed, kind of very similar style of like, here's what the academia says, but actually the academia bit is probably only a couple of lines, and then it's just a story and an example of how that was seen. And Daniel H. Pink, his work's very much the same as that as well. You could probably say Amy Edmondson's book, this big popular psychological safety book, that's probably the same as well, in that there's so much academia behind it, but it's like, how do we make it accessible to like the common person that's trying to, the practitioners of the world that need this information, that don't want to sit down and read academic papers.
That's right.
I could see a lot of that actually in your writing.
Yeah, no, I mean, thank you. And you know, like I aspire for those people to be, you know, my peers in many ways, right? I mean, you know, Dan Pink, I mean, these writers are amazing. Charles Duhigg was kind of an inspiration too. I mean, I thought Power of Habit was just a great book in terms of this genre. And you know, even there, I think is a good example, right? Like, I don't know, I probably would still write the same book that I wrote in some sense. And now I'm aware of like, okay, you know, what are the conversations that are going on right now that I can contribute something to? And I still think there's contributions to make around this topic of complexity. The thing I think I've learned from Meltdown, to make it a little bit more concrete, between, you know, when that came out and now, and this kind of goes to your point, Meltdown is written at a little bit of a level of abstraction that I think I didn't understand at the time, where, you know, we'll say something in the book, like it's really oriented towards solutions, and like a solution, like openly discuss errors with your team, you know, is very easy to write down on a piece of paper. But if you are even a senior leader in an organization, and that's not the culture of your organization, then the question becomes, well, okay, that's a great idea. How am I going to do that? How am I going to actually create that culture where people are curious and open and discussing mistakes and seeing these as learning moments rather than being in that kind of blame framework? And in some sense, you know, in the last 2-3 years, that's really been my work, to help leaders go from, well, this is theoretically a good idea, to, okay, how do I actually create the culture of my team, create the culture of my organization, create change in my organization to do these things? And so for me, that's been the skills that I've learned and ended up bringing to my work, which is all about, how do I support leaders in creating change in their organizations? And you know, how do I support leaders in supporting their frontline workers in, you know, working at their expertise instead of having to fit into some kind of bureaucratic system that doesn't really make sense? So I think for me, that's the bit, that's the transition bit for me.
I want to get into this leadership piece, because I've got a couple of questions and maybe some topics for us to get into around that. But I do have one question actually around complexity, to bring you all the way back to your original kind of work piece. There is, you know, when you get like the normal accident theory, and it has examples of like tightly coupled and complex organizations, and it'll say things like a nuclear plant, for example.
Sure. Yep.
And then it will put a lot of things like I don't know, like school, for example, in like not complex and not tightly coupled.
Right.
Do you think that model is up to date? Because I think the world that we live in now, a school is a very complex and tightly coupled system.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. And, you know, we sort of, I mean, we thought it got hard when writing the book to figure out examples that weren't complex and tightly coupled in some sense. And I think the overarching statement there is that the world of the early 1980s and the world of the 2020s are very different worlds from a complexity and tight coupling perspective. And, you know, I mean, as soon as you said schools, I mean, what I thought about is, you know, there's a ton of things to think about with that, right? But one, just, I mean, social media has for one thing, right? And the role of social media in schools, and you know, the fact that anything that is said in a classroom can be in the world in 30 seconds, right? I mean, it's just an incredible amount, an incredible layer of tight coupling that just was not there before. And then you've got technology systems behind that. You've got, you know, the kind of the background of the political world that we live in, you know, this kind of politics of outrage that we have here in the US, kind of all around us. So yes, I think I'm totally with you. I think that there is much less now that is in that kind of, you know, loosely coupled, non-complex part of the spectrum. I mean, even in Perrault's time, you know, like car, you know, you could have a car engine that was a simple system, right? I mean, yes, it's a piece of machinery. And if it's basically driven by, you know, spark plugs and a distributor cap, then it is simple, it is understandable. Whereas, you know, we read about Volkswagen Dieselgate, but you look at, I mean, you know, every car these days is made with a ton of software, right? A ton of computers in it. And sometimes they fail in weird ways. So yeah, no, I'm with you. I think the amount in our world that is not complex is getting smaller and smaller and smaller, at least in the developed West.
I also am cautious now that what ends up happening is that Perrault gets the Heinrich treatment, where we all just start saying Perrault's stupid and his work is stupid, and that we unfairly tar him with this doesn't work in the modern world. Well, it's like, well, yeah, that's because he didn't write it in the world right now, did he? He wrote it way back in like the 80s or whatever it was, or the 60s or something. Like, so I don't mean that when I ask that question to be like, oh, it's a stupid model and it doesn't work. Like, no, the theory is right. But actually, like, if we were to just go off of the picture that we get on Google and we Google normal accident theory, if we just went off that, we would probably go down the wrong path to start to think some things are not complex and some things are. Well, actually, in the world we live in now, a lot of it is really complex. And I do think your book does I do think yours and Andras's book does a really good job of that. I actually think in our guidebook, we quote in this one, I think it might be in the next one, I can't remember, and we reference it as well, don't worry, but I'm pretty sure we kind of, and I pretty much say this all the time, in that, like, if Chris and Andras think that making Christmas dinner, or I think you guys would call it Thanksgiving dinner, but like, over here, we're not weird. We have just Christmas. But like, if that's complex, like, surely your business is complex. Like, come on, let's not kid ourselves. If making a Sunday roast dinner is a complex and tightly coupled system, then so is your business.
That's right. Yeah, no, that's, I think I like how you put that. And I will say about Perrault, I mean, we spent a couple of days with him, just kind of being with him. He didn't really know what to expect from us. But I think with a combination of like Andras's credentials and my persistence, he agreed to meet with us, and then agreed to meet with us for like an hour, and then we ended up spending 2 days with him in New Haven. You know, he was a pretty amazing combination of brilliant and humble and curious, which I think all of us could do well to emulate. I mean, you know, here we were, these people that didn't know who we were. I mean, Andres has a PhD from Harvard, so that's kind of a helpful thing for somebody who is prestige oriented, which he really wasn't. I mean, he was engaging in conversation with us. He could tell right away that we had actually read his stuff, that we had read Normal Accident Theory, that we weren't a kind of, you know, uninformed journalist that was sort of coming by, that we weren't in fact journalists. Not that there's anything against journalism, a lot of great journalists out there. and he was, I gotta be careful, right?
You trying to navigate
some of my best friends are journalists. he was really quite humble in letting us kind of like push and prod on this theory that he had created. And he would say things like, oh, that's a really interesting take. I wish I would have thought of that before. Right. So it was really interesting to kind of just like play with him intellectually. And I think he would be
nice.
Really, really delighted for this kind of conversation.
That's nice. I don't want to go down this rabbit hole, but I feel like I need to say it, that seems to be something that's lacking in modern day academics. I don't feel a lot alike. So when I fed back to you, like where we started this conversation, that was that you were a pleasure to speak to, that's in reflection of those big thought leaders, particularly in safety, that we've had on, have been some of it's been some of the worst interviews that we've done, and it's been really not humble, it felt quite arrogant, hard to get a conversation in, doesn't listen to different opinions, which is ironic because like we're your customer, so like if I don't get it, you've got a problem in how you're selling your product, mate. So I found that interesting, but that's nice to hear that Charles is like that, and what an amazing experience that must have been.
It was an amazing experience. Yeah, and I think he passed away in 20. I think it was 2019. Because I think I remember I had just had lunch with Tim Hartford and Amy Edmondson in London. I brought the three of us together for a lunch. It was
lunch. Yeah, I bet that was a boring conversation. Jeez,
it was fun. It was a pretty fun conversation, and it was right around when Tim was launching Cautionary Tales. So it was kind of cool to hear kind of what, you know, what was on his mind and what he was working on. But I just say that because I think we either had found out at that, like right before that lunch. And I think Amy maybe knew, I don't remember, somebody brought it to the lunch and then we kind of all knew, and we just had a sort of moment, or it might've been a couple of days later. I don't remember. This is how good human memory is. But you said something there that was, you know, this is actually kind of a nice bridge to the conversation about leadership, because I think that something that can happen to all of us is that, and I think especially if you view your idea, if you identify with your idea as your product, like something that can happen to all of us is that we really, we want to be right. And we really feel like our job is to know the answer. And I think that's a thing that I've noticed a lot with the leaders I work with, that, the start of my kind of, I won't say leaving Meltdown behind, but the start of my kind of transitioning from Meltdown as the center of what I do to kind of the supporting foundation in some sense, was when I was working with a team in 2020, and it was a kind of safety and maintenance team at a big, at a big global oil and gas company. And they were really trying to transform the way their organization approached maintenance, approached safety. And they were sort of stuck. And they had asked me to come in and do a couple of workshops, which, because it was mid-pandemic, we're all on Zoom. And the first one went well, and the second one felt a little bit stilted to me. And so I was going into this third one, and I realized that I was feeling really anxious about it. And I was like, gosh, I'm gonna show, I don't know what to talk to them about. Like they have this complex problem. They're asking me for help. Like, I feel a lot of pressure to show up and kind of give them an answer. And then I was like, oh, that's interesting. And I was doing some coaching training at the time, and my mentor, my teacher in that program, is still a mentor of mine. I remember he said something like, he had just done a coaching demo, and then he said something like, "You know, I'm getting really interested in not knowing." And I said, "What the hell is this guy talking about?" That was what my brain. I remember that thought very distinctly. What the hell is this guy talking about? Getting interested in not knowing. So that kind of got me interested in not knowing and what it meant to not know. And so I went to this third workshop, and I said, "Hey, you know, I realized that I have been feeling a lot of kind of anxiety coming to this workshop. And what I have realized is that I feel this pressure to know the answer, to come in and to give you guys some kind of answer about your problem." And I said, "But I don't know the answer. And, you know, actually, even if I did, you know, quote unquote, know the answer, like, it wouldn't really matter because you all wouldn't believe me. You know, you've got decades of experience in this industry. And if I came in saying, this is how you do it, you know, you'd find all sorts of problems with that and you'd be right." And I said, "But that makes me wonder, do you all feel pressure to know the answer?" And they were all just like, "Yes." And just kind of like unleashed this kind of tension in the room was wow. there. And so what that did is that freed us up as a group to shift from this idea of like, okay, the job here is to know the answer, to shift to the idea that like, actually what we're here to do is just to try things, to figure, to play with stuff, to figure things out, to, you know, to experiment, to stop thinking in terms of kind of how do we solve this problem across this massively complex organization and start thinking in terms of like, well, what's one thing we can do? What's the next thing we can do to kind of A, you know, make this better, advance this work? How do we think in terms of experiments and you know, find people that are willing to play with this change, with this organization, you know, with this small team inside this company and go and build on those success. And in fact, that's exactly what they did. And 3 years later, they've gone from a team of like six people to like 75 people, having a huge impact in their organization. And I'm still getting to work with them. It's really, really satisfying. Mm. And I think if you're, you know, this idea of not knowing is really, it's hard to embrace. It's hard to be an expert and embrace not knowing. And I think that's like, we talked just a little bit about this before we hit record, but that's part of what I'm really interested in. I'm really interested in supporting leaders in this moment where they like, yes, they have some expertise, and the expertise that they've brought with them so far in their career, it's not what is needed to sort of support them in doing the next thing, you know, building culture change, building a cohesive and empowered team. You know, they need something, they still need that expertise, and they need that expertise to rest in the background a little bit. So they're not kind of leading with it like a stick that they're whacking people with, trying to convince people of things. It informs their stance. It informs what they know. And what they realize is that the whole way that they're going to work effectively is by building relationships with people.
I wonder how much of that anxiety though comes from like a societal expectation that a leader should know something. Like being totally. In a position is like you, it's really interesting. So I kind of experience that anxiety, but in a different way, like when we do workshops and stuff, for sure, totally get it, but also probably get more anxious when we put YouTube content out, TikTok content out, podcast content out. I get a lot more anxiety on that, particularly because it's still a very lonely space on YouTube. There's not a lot of people in safety doing it, particularly the more technical side of safety, but there's not a lot of people doing it. The other side is that whenever we get those comments that like, so we did a TikTok the other day where I was purposely like, let's say aggressive. I was purposely aggressive about a topic, which is a really silly but important topic, which is something that's very popular, particularly in the UK, called Toolbox Talks. So I tarred them all with the same brush, and I said, you know, they're absolute shite and they're a waste of time. And essentially that's a reflection of what the shop floor think of them. And they're our customers, right? So you only have to spend 2 minutes on TikTok to see what people think about safety. You only have to spend 2 minutes on a construction site, talk to a builder to know what they think, particularly in the UK, about safety. And anyway, the comments, like, Jesus Christ. We put it out on LinkedIn, and the second it went out on LinkedIn, I was like, this is such a bad idea. I should not have done this. just like safety professionals that essentially are immediately defensive of this. And then I feel like they're immediately essentially attacking my competence because I put myself in a position of, I don't want to say leadership, but like, you know, there's not many people making this content. So naturally, I suppose people think if you're making content, you must know what you're doing. But anyway, we're making this content. Every comment that is remotely critical is like really hard to deal with. It's really hard to deal with. So I can really empathize with that. And people will nitpick on these little bits. And it was interesting that one guy in particular said, in my little jokey thing, I was like, yeah, there are three types of a asbestos. And there's more types than three. But this guy was like, oh, you clearly don't know what you're talking about. There's actually six types of asbestos. And I was just like, that's what people expect from people leading, is that if you know a lot about that, you have to know a lot about everything. Otherwise, you don't deserve to be a leader.
Yeah, well, this is a great, it's a great point. And I think what I think is true, true is a strong word. So if we go back to our conversation a minute ago about the whole world is getting more complex and getting more into this, I think there are fewer and fewer problems where leaders' role is actually to know the answer. Because even if you look at, like, again, a quote unquote relatively simple organization, you know, it's a complex system, right? And so one of the my favorite back in the envelope definition of a complex system is like, it is a system where, you know, no one person can hold all of the information, right? No one person can hold all of the pieces. So I think if you think about this moment that we're in when it comes to leadership, like, we are really challenging, and I think the kind of, you know, the Taylorist or the Henry Ford model of there is a boss who knows the answer and the boss, you know, tells people what to do and then those people do it. That model is totally broken, right? The model is in fact inverted. It is the people at the front line who know the answer, and we need a cadre of leadership who has the ability to listen to them, to get insights about their business, so they can bring the kind of strategic and business context to their decisions. But middle management is and senior leadership, it is a very, very hard role to be in these days. I think you need just a wide, wide variety of skills. You need to, you know, again, be able to listen to people, and you need to be able to bring that strategic orientation to things. And it's only that combination that I think, you know, actually moves us forward. So the pressure you're feeling is very much a real pressure, right? And look, we go through, I mean, our whole schooling, our whole educational system is designed to present us with solvable problems that we then come up with an answer to. I mean, what you're, you know, there's also a bit of marketing mixed in with what we're doing and what people say about marketing. And I'm not a marketing expert, you know, despite the fact that I kind of do a lot of it in my work. But what people say is essentially, you know, it's okay to be polarizing, right? Your goal is not to get people to like you. You know, your goal is to get people to notice you and to kind of to create a tribe. If you tap into Seth Godin's language around, like, who are the people that are really going to benefit by following you? And it's probably not the person that you know knows or cares about the six types of asbestos, because at least at this stage, maybe they're very oriented towards that expertise, and you're kind of talking about something different. But you know, they watched it, they consumed it, right? Like, maybe there's an opening for them that comes from that.
There is also this, like, the knock-on effect of that is that it can be very lonely, I think, as a leader, particularly if you're in like a small business, like, and you're leading a small business, and you are even you could be quite a big business, to be fair, and still have a lot of it essentially go through one person, or have one true leader or visionary for the business or whatever. And that can be quite stressful and quite lonely, to feel like society expects you to have all the answers for everything. I know from running our businesses that's hard, and it does feel like that sometimes, even though it's not necessarily it is for me, but I can see it in a lot of our customers as well. When I'm looking at these leaders in a business, and it's just like, God, everyone looks to you for an answer. Like, you must be shattered.
Yeah. So there's two things we can talk about here. So one thing I'd like to share a little bit about my team and kind of how we do things and how we think about things. And then I think there is something about that loneliness that is worth mentioning more broadly, or that feeling of isolation that's worth mentioning more broadly. So
I also would add another bit onto those two
yeah.
breakdowns of that, but I'd probably follow up with a question. So just to, in case you're going to answer it, and you might answer it already, but another question would be, does that leader kind of unconsciously create that situation themselves through a lack of comfortableness with letting go as well? Like, do they create that loneliness because they're not allowing other people to do, if I may, or to make that, they're not given the autonomy, there we go, within the business. That's the best way for me to
Yeah,
explain it.
that's a great way to do it. So we've got three things here. So here's the thing I'll say about my business and the way I work with my team. There's two kind of things. We brought in some two coaches that I've worked with in other capacities. We brought them in to work with our team at the beginning of the year around we run a sprint process. So, every 6 weeks or so, we run a kind of sprint where we've got two, usually it's two, because that's kind of what our capacity is on top of all of our kind of run work. But we've got two things that we're working to improve,
Right.
and it can be externally facing or it can be internally facing. So it can be like one thing, one sprint we ran was like simplify our project management system. So we spent 6 weeks kind of understanding the challenge we were facing, coming up with ways of solving it, implementing that, and then getting feedback from people. That was a kind of
And the
sprint
whole
that we
team is working on that sprint project whilst also doing what do you call the running of the business, which is
ran.
actually running of the business.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. And different people on the team will have different roles. So we have I have like a finance person. So she kind of was part of that sprint project, both giving input, but then also organizing her own space in that project management platform, kind of according to our principles that we discovered. So yes, and sometimes it's only, not every project involves everybody in the business. So it's kind of this mix. And as we were setting up this sprint process, which my colleague Rain runs, we talked about what kind of team we were going to be, or what kind of team we were. And it's pretty interesting because, I mean, I'm the primary producer for the business, right? I mean, I'm coaching, I'm doing the consulting. I now have this product, which I'll talk about in a little bit, which is a little bit not hands off for me because I'm still very involved, but I'm not always the one delivering everything in that, or at least that's the vision for it. But so there's a way that we've talked about our team is sometimes our team operates like a surgical team, where it's like, I'm the surgeon, I'm gonna do consulting, like let's say go and run a workshop, right? Or something like that, or go and run a strategy. I do strategy mapping work with leaders, oftentimes on safety teams. It's like, okay, really, what is the strategy of this safety team? What are you all here to do? Because if it's just you don't have a strategy, then you're just kind of constantly getting buffeted by the waves. So I'm going to go run a 2 day workshop, right? What do I want? I really do want to be like a surgeon. I want to show up with the preparation I've done, and I want everything else to just be in place. I don't want to have to think about like how I'm getting from the hotel to the venue. I don't want to think about, any of that stuff, or how I get from the airport to the hotel. Like, it may sound a bit like a prima donna, and I don't think I am a prima donna. Maybe, I don't know. You can we'll put that in the judgment section at the end of the podcast that we promised people. But like, what I want to be there, I want to be focused on the work, right? And I want to be like, scalpel, and then I want the scalpel to be there. I want the handouts to be at the client site. Like, I don't want to be, I'll do a little bit of schlepping, right? But I'd like to generally minimize my schlepping so I can focus on being in the moment. Or, booking things, right? Like my coaching clients, like I don't want to think about when we're going to meet. I just want to show up and be with them, right? That's where I'm affected. So there's part of our team that's organized kind of like a surgical team where I am the surgeon, and it's sort of, I'm always being very clear about what I want. We're always iterating and learning, but that's organized around the production aspects of this. And then there's aspects of it that are where we're like a football team, right? Where we are kind of people on the field together. We all need to care, or there's going to be gaps and there's going to be holes, and we are jointly determining our direction and our strategy and what we're going to do. And so for me to change it, I mean, it's tricky, right? I've got to really change hats and sort of remind myself, like, okay, actually, I want to hold my voice back here because I'm not showing up as the surgeon here, right? I'm showing up as a partner. Ooh. And if I participate equally, then my voice is going to be, I'm going to dominate, right? So, so it's been really interesting to kind of build those muscles for us as a team. And then I think your other two points, you know, about loneliness and about, so I'll say built on that, you know, I say to my team all of the time, like, hey, I just want to be clear. Like, I don't know what we're doing here. Like, we're really just figuring this out. Like, we are, you know, I'm really transparent and really open about our process and about my process. Like, yeah, here's the thing I'd like to try here. I'm not sure how it's going to work out. You know, what objections or concerns do you have? Right. Those are the kinds of conversations we have. And I think, you know, that really, I mean, I do so much to kind of, I mean, also with my clients too, like I'm always saying, you know, I am not here as somebody who has figured this out. I am here as somebody who is on this journey with you. Because I think that kind of modeling is important. And I think we really need to admit so much more that we don't know the answer. And the more that we can all just be in that conversation and destigmatize that, I think the better off we all are.
Yeah. It's fascinating, isn't it? Because there's definitely this transition that we're hopefully going through, where maybe society within a business or society as a general as well, like, start to understand that that a leader is still a human, right? So they have fallibilities. They also can't have all the answers. You're part of that, giving them, making and thinking of the answer. But interestingly as well, like, I can never pronounce his name, so I'm not even going to bother, but the head of Toyota during the whole, like, I don't know what you would call it. Would that be Sigma? No, it wouldn't be. Like, the whole, like, it wouldn't be Six Sigma, would it? What's the...
Oh, they're lean?
Yeah, like, the original version of it, though. Not what you see nowadays, which is just freaking shadow boards and stuff, but, like, the proper stuff of it, where if you look back on, like, classic Toyota, there's these amazing stories of, like, this leader who's like going down to the shop floor and telling, you know, begging people to tell him everything that's wrong with the business. And when people are coming to him and being like, oh, here's everything that's right, he's like, I don't give a shit about what's right. I want to know what's wrong. And it's like, wow, that was a freaking long time ago that this person was doing that. And we still kind of haven't picked it up. So there's part of me as a grumpy old kind of skeptic that's like, we haven't got it all these years past. Why are we going to get it now? However, then the more positive side of me is kind of like, I'm seeing a lot more of these conversations, which is really positive. Interestingly, though, I'm not necessarily seeing a shift in the demand from the shop floor from a leader. I feel like the demand from the shop floor is security and that feeling of, like, yeah, security in a way. And they feel like they get that from a leader that has all the answers. And I remember going through a business redesign. I think it was a business redesign. I can't remember. It was something, and it's a period of change in an organization. And the business had done it, what I would say, the right way. So they essentially came to, like, middle management and senior management, and I was part of the, like, SLT kind of group. And they came to us and they said, like, we need solutions. Like, we want ideas. We don't have the answer, but here's what we think the problem is. Please, can you go away and come up with something? And I just want to throw shit at the wall and see what sticks, kind of thing. And I was like, wow. Like, and then I think it was, I can't remember what job it was, but wherever I was, well, I can, but I don't want to mention it. but ultimately, like, I was at this organization that really was like this old fashioned, traditional, like, not very nice place to work in a lot of points in the business, coming to us with this really mature, like, modern way of working. And I was like, Wow. The really interesting thing was the overarching feedback from middle management and the SLT was, you're supposed to come with us the answers. We're not supposed to give you the answers. And I was like, wow, that's fascinating. And I've never really forgot that. And I don't really see much of a change from that in the last, like, say, 3 or 4 years.
Right. Well, it's, I mean, you put your finger on, there's a bunch of interesting things in that story. Thanks for sharing it. I mean, the two of the things that stand out for me are, one, you can't do this stuff overnight, right? So,
yeah.
So people are patterned into a certain way of working, and, you know, rightfully skeptical when, you know, leadership shows up with, hey, this is our whole new way. It's like, well, really? Yeah. Like, cause they've also been through, you know, this is the fifth or sixth time that their company has done a reorganization or claim that they're going to be working with a new set of principles or whatever. And, you know, ultimately that those often don't stick. So I think there has to be a habit. And I also think, to your point, that there is a sort of, you know, almost like false comfort in this belief that leaders know the answer and that you are supposed to just follow them, right? And I think the thing I think that leaders need to bring is a confidence in their framework, right? Like a strong process, right? That's what I think leaders need to bring. And I think there is a transition point where, as leaders, we get to stop focusing on our expertise and start focusing on, how do we create a strong container for solving challenges collectively, right? How do we
facilitate within a framework meetings? Kind of thing.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Mm. So to me, that's kind of what I see the transition as. And I do think that there's a lot of forces, you know, cultural and otherwise, that say that leaders are supposed to know the answer. And I think, you know, one way you could conceive of the job of a leader is that they're supposed to do the right thing, even when it's unpopular, even when it's hard. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of, that includes admitting that you don't know the answer and bringing that vulnerability to things and taking the first step.
I'm really glad, just selfishly, I'm really glad that's where you went with that story, because where I went with that story has led to a key part of our framework of what we do is that you mentioned habits, like you've got to have to be a habit over a time of doing. You can't just turn up, change the way you work, and then expect everyone to be like, wow, this is amazing. Some people will, you know, those early adopters and stuff, but most people will be like, oh, this is a bit weird. And we talk about it like, essentially what you're trying to drive is like a cultural change within the business. And that actually comes over a long period of time from interaction after interaction after interaction, like habitual interactions. And you can have, I mean, like the way we describe it would be like, you can have interactions that don't contribute to that end goal, but as long as there's more of the ones that do than there is of the ones that don't. So I was kind of like, when you went there with that, I was like, I'm glad, because that's kind of what we've been saying, which is good. So I feel like we've got it right. I've got some validation out of that, Chris. So thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome. I mean, I think if we just stay with that for a moment, because I really do join you in that view of things. I think a thing that leaders can easily make a mistake with, or sort of lead themselves astray with in some sense, is you've got to invite people's energy. You've got to match people's energy and the level of engagement you're willing to take from them, basically. So what do I mean by that? If you are actually feeling really, really open about co-creating a strategy with your team, then by all means, really invite their energy, right? Invite their participation, really energize them, you know, invest in that. If you're not, though, if you know what strategy you want, but you want people to feel like they have gone through some kind of participatory process, like, don't do that, right? Because people know at the end of the day, if you're really holding the decision tightly to your chest and you invite them to this big participatory process and then kind of do the thing that everybody suspected you would do to begin with, it's awful, right? You've really kind of, you've burned a tremendous amount of trust and political capital with people. It's not to say that you can't just make the decision you want, right? But then you're just informing people, right? So, and it's not that you have to, and I think people often make this mistake where they feel like, well, if I invite everybody in, then I'm going to lose control of the conversation and they're going to take things in a direction that isn't right for the business or doesn't feel right. And I don't think that's right. I think as long as you invite people in with clarity that you are going to make the final decision, then that's totally fine. Then you're just inviting them to participate in a different way. But the real tragedy is when you as a leader mismatch the kind of energy with the actual level of participation, not the stated level of participation.
I really like that actually, because how we would kind of, I think maybe say the same message in that when we talk about like leadership styles, so everyone would be like autocratic and democratic and I don't know, like rule based and all of these different ways of working, right? And you might get different characters. So people might be like, oh, this is a Gates and this is a Jobs and then this is a Obama and so on. And you'd be like, oh, which style of leader is the LinkedIn would say this is the leader that you want. And it's like, well, not really, because it depends on the situation. Like, actually, if this is an emergency situation, I don't really want someone that's going to be going around going, hi, what's your opinion? Hi, well, right. I want someone with a big pair of cojones that's going to make a decision and then work out whether it was right or wrong. Like, just make the decision. Let's do something because this is a novel and emergency situation. Whereas if we're trying to drive big transformation, then I don't really want that person that just doesn't really listen to people. I want someone very different. I want someone who is democratic and, you know, listening and going out and getting consensus and stuff. But there is this kind of message I pick up sometimes in that people will favoritism a style of something, particularly leadership, and then demonize another style of leadership, which actually in certain situations would be really good.
That's right. That's such a good way to put it. And it resonates so much with me because, you know, I do a lot of one-on-one coaching with senior leaders, and they're fairly senior in their business, which means they've got a leadership style at this point in time. And given that we're working together, they see a challenge that this leadership style isn't supporting them to meet. And so the way I always talk about my coaching is that we're working to grow people's ranges, right? So, you know, I think you put that so beautifully, like, you want to be able to show up with the leadership style that supports you in the situation in, supports you in, yeah. in solving the challenge that you're trying to solve. And, you know, so I went away and, well, went away. I sat at my desk, but I talked to people in different places. I spent time over the summer interviewing probably about 30 leaders from different businesses, different industries, different levels of leadership, some of whom I had worked with very closely, who'd been longtime clients, some of whom I had was just meeting for the first time was something that somebody had passed on to me, or a connection that somebody had made. And I sort of started out by asking kind of what did they, and these were all people who led teams or were part of influencing organizations. So I kind of think of both of those things as leadership. And if I just stick with the teams aspect of it for a moment, I sort of started by asking them kind of, you know, what do you see as the most important thing to leading your team to success? And what kind of percolated through those conversations was that what people really wanted was a kind of cohesive team that was empowered to make the right decisions and that had enough context to make the right decisions and that ultimately had their eye on the results that they were trying to drive. And so that was really what focused me, kind of this question of how do leaders create cohesive and empowered teams that get results, that really do advance their work and are doing the right work, right? Advancing the work of the company or the organization or the division or whatever the right unit of analysis is. And so that was a really interesting process. And so I did those interviews, I kind of transcribed them all, stuck them in ChatGPT. He had conversations with ChatGPT about them, sort of leaned back and kind of blurred my eyes a little bit, and then also brought in my own consulting and coaching work and sort of brought in like, okay, well, what have I seen work in organizations? What have I seen work with individual leaders? What are the challenges I'm, you know, the leaders that I'm working with are bringing? And so I went away and I really did go away for a little while and just kind of go into my own thought space for a while, marinated a little bit, and kind of out the other side, I created this framework that I'm calling the CLEAR Leadership Framework. And CLEAR is an acronym that stands for curiosity and listening, empowerment and accountability, and results. And you can see that curiosity and listening are sort of twins of each other. So if you're curious, we're going to ask people questions. The next thing you need to be able to do is listen, right? And if you're empowering people, if you're kind of giving people a chance to do independent work on their own, you've also got to have that accountability mechanism where you can have, you know, not the traditional kind of like blame style of accountability conversations that I think so many of us, you know, grew up having in school and our jobs or being the subject of, is maybe a better way to put it. But this kind of collaborative accountability. Accountability is a way to learn. Accountability is a way to grow. And then the results bit is sort of, how do you tie that all together? One of the things I see with a lot of leaders, even very sophisticated leaders, is they have a kind of like an inherited model of leadership where, you know, they have the kind of meetings with their team or their meetings with their boss that they sort of grew up having without ever really having the chance to take a step back and say like, well, hang on, like, why are we having fortnightly one-on-ones? Like, what's the purpose of these? Could we accomplish that purpose in a different way? You know, I don't have one-on-one meetings with my team outside of doing specific work, right? So if we're doing a piece of work together, we'll meet to advance that work. The one exception that I make is I meet with everybody in my organization, and we're small, so that's feasible. You know, about every quarter, between every quarter, every 3-4 months, between 15 minutes and an hour, I'll spend with people, and it's just about our relationship. Like, how is our work going? What do you like about it? What do you not like about it? What's your situation? Do you want to do more of something? Do you want to do less of something? How are we working together? You know, what do you love about this work? What do you not love about it? How do you feel about compensation? Like, you know, those kinds of questions that are these sort of big questions that, you know, if you're having, I don't care how many weekly one-on-ones, like nobody's going to, you know, slot that between their status report on a project, like to go deep and talk about, you know, what they care about the work. So anyway, that results piece also involves kind of how do you own the process as a leader? So that framework, I mean, that hope is, or what I see is I see that framework is kind of like being a bridge to take a lot of the senior leaders I work with that are, you know, very, very skillful, and just kind of like round out their skill set so that they really can lead at that senior level, knowing what they're going to do, knowing that their teams understand the overall context of their work and are on the same page, and, you know, being able to really lead with much more ease and also get more done. It's a pretty cool combination.
I think what's really interesting is every single question you went through was more from the, it sounded, it was context of, from the context of like, what can we do to help you? Whereas previous, my experience of being an employee in those conversations are, what do you want from me as an employee? Like, it was more like, so tell me about your performance. How do you think your performance is? Whereas this time you're saying, tell me about your compensation and how do you feel like you're being compensated in the business? Do you need more? How are you? How's your workload? That's a very different narrative from typical Western ways of working, particularly. I couldn't speak for anywhere outside of England, really, to be honest.
Right. No, fair enough. But yeah, no, that's exactly it. It is a... And look, I don't go into those meetings. Sometimes people say, I'd like to get paid more for this. And I say, I hear you. You know, I don't go into those meetings. There's no promise that just because the topic is open that we're going to be able to fix it. But boy, are they better off having shared? And am I better off for knowing where they're at? Right. I mean, it's exactly, everybody is better off.
I've found this really interesting going through recruitment over the last 2 months of being like, the responses that people look at me a bit like, and I'm kind of like, what salary do you need? like and want. So like to sustain your way of life and your happiness and how you are, what do you need? Tell me. If it's over the bracket, tell me it's over the bracket. Because then I can make a decision. I could go, right, I'm going to employ Chris, even though I know Chris is already needs something over the bracket. So I'm going to make him an offer. I might go out of bracket, I might not, but I'll make him an offer. And then at least I have in my head, I know Chris wants to get to X salary, so I need to get there quick if I want to keep him. Or I just go, look, Chris, I'd really like what you do, mate, and I'd love to employ you, but I cannot provide you with the remuneration that you need to sustain your way of life. And if we did that and you cut too much, there's going to be a real tight time frame on that, which I don't think I can deliver on. Or we go, look, this is all I can do. I'm going to work my fucking ass off to try and make sure you get to that point. Like, this is operating off of this point of like openness and honesty.
That's
but
right.
People are really uncomfortable with it. They think I'm playing a game with them to like, you know, the old like, so what are you currently paid to like undercut it or like not pay as much as I want? And I'm like, please believe me, I'm not coming from that space. I'm coming from the space of like, I want you to come and work for me and I want you to stay with me. So I need to know what you want.
Yeah. Well, and I think you put your finger on something very important, which is, I think at the focus of so much of this leadership work, you know, listening, for example, which is just a huge piece of work. And actually the program that I'm creating out of this framework, a lot of the, so there's content, you know, in each of these modules, but it's a 12-week program called The Clear Path to Executive Leadership. And the content is just a small part of it, right? So much of it is about practice. How do you listen to people? You know, how do you actually empower people in a way that where they understand what you're asking them to do and you understand that they understand, right? So how do you kind of close the loop on how you empower people? But to your point about these conversations, you know, so much about it is building trust, right? Building trust over time with people. And so, you know, if you're not able to build trust as part of that hiring process, then it's going to be a lot harder for somebody to say that.
And like, so when we first went to market for the first role we recruited, someone who was way out of bracket approached us and was like, I want to work for you, but we need to have a conversation about this. And I was like, I want you to work for me, but we need to have a conversation about how this works because I know I can't afford you and you want to. And it was just this honest conversation that we could have where we were like, do you know what? I think we could actually work something out. You go away and have a think about that. And I'll go away and have a think about that. And then let's come back and see what happens. And now I know I'm very happy with him and the team. I believe he tells me that he's very happy with us as well.
Right.
But like if we both didn't have this really honest conversation with each other, that was just kind of like, tell me what you want. And like, and I was really clear, like that needs to be not like, oh, I can survive on this. It needs to be, I can still have a takeaway on Friday. I can still go for a beer and do the things I want to. Because if you're miserable because you can't afford life, like you're not going to work very well for me. And that's not what I want. You're not going to be very happy. And we were able to have that honest conversation. So I've seen it work. I've literally seen, not through like design, it just was me and him just, we made it happen. And then we were like, shit, that was really good, actually. And I've learned so much in that process from him coming on board, 100%.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
So, Chris, I'm conscious of time. I want you to plug this product that you've been telling us about. So run me through what is the product? So you said it's a clear path. It sounds like it's a program with content and stuff, but like run me through it, kind of cradle to grave and who it's for and so on. I know you said exec leaders.
Yeah. So it's for leaders who are really stepping into that more senior role. So they're stepping out of that player coach role where they're kind of, you know, on a team, but kind of contributing technically and more into this senior role. And, you know, my observation is what these folks really benefit from is some support in leaning into curiosity instead of knowing the answers, leaning into curiosity, obviously still carrying their expertise with them, but having it play a supporting role instead of being kind of what they lead with. So it's a 12-week program. As I said, we've got content around, you know, curiosity, listening, empowerment, accountability, and results. people do a little mini project as part of it, which is directly relevant to their work. It's not like a, you know, BS kind of add-on thing, but we give them feedback on them advancing a specific work project. There's group coaching as part of it, which is like supporting each other in leadership challenges, but also learning to practice listening. And then 3 one-on-one coaching sessions as part of it. So focus on your strength as a leader, focus on, you know, your strategy and empowering people. And then focused on the last one focuses on how you kind of go into the world and bring results. So, you know, if you're a leader, nice. If you're a safety leader, or if you're somebody in the safety world that is trying to grow your influence, and wants to kind of learn to lead more effectively, you have to be really interested in your own leadership for this to be something that would be a good fit for you. But if you are, and if you want to join a community of other people, the easiest thing to do is go to clearfieldgroup.com, and we have like 12 book a call CTA buttons. So just find one of those, book a call. It'll be
just
you.
Push a button.
We'll yeah, find the button. It'll be you and me. We'll have a half hour call that's kind of about your leadership and where you are in the journey and what's important to you. Yeah, I think that's probably the best way to get connected.
Cool. And we'll make sure we put your website in the description below as well so people can go and check that out, mate.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Yeah, that sounds really cool. Does it matter on like size of business? Because if like a really small kind of startup or, you know, just medium-sized business, would they still benefit from it?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, so I've been thinking a lot about this. Yeah, I do have people from some smaller businesses. So, you know, and we've been talking a lot about the complexity of small businesses in this time together. And that's really one of the things I'm taking away. But yeah, I think if you're, you know, if you are leading a team, or if you, I have somebody who's the CEO of a 50 person startup in the program, they are our medical device startup. And you know, my price point, I mean, I'm charging 3,000 for the program, 3,000 US. Right. If you're somebody in a corporate role, if you're somebody in a smaller business, I'm happy to talk about a discount. I give a discount to people like hospitals, healthcare, not-for-profits, civil service, who are kind of doing good works. That's only 2,000 US for them for the program. And if you're kind of a smaller business who feels like this would be important for you, but that 3,000 price point is out of reach, let's have a conversation about that.
Cool. Amazing. That's amazing. Thank you very much, mate. Hey, look, I'm going to let go. But it's such a pleasure talking to you, mate. Thank you very much. If I could have hours and hours talking to you, I would. But unfortunately, we've all got lives.
Yeah, totally. You know, I'm going to be in the UK for the HSE Global Conference. That's June 25th, 26th.
Oh, yeah, Paul Clark's event.
Yeah, Paul Clark's outfit. Yep. So maybe I'll see you there.
I'll have a look, mate. I haven't been to one of his for a while, actually. So yeah, I will have a look at that. But yeah, that's cool. I'll put a link to the website for that as well in the stuff below as well. Right, mate. Brilliant. I'm gonna have to shoot. James, but thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome. Great to talk to you. Take care.
See you later, buddy. Thank you.
Expressed in this podcast are those of the host and its guest and do not necessarily reflect the position of the companies. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are examples only based on limited and dated open source information and should not be utilised in real life as the only solution available. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the companies. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic or otherwise, without prior written permission from James McPherson.